You're tuned to Radio Overberg 98.4. I'm Anna-Marie, and today I have a very distinguished guest in the studio, in the person of Henry Holloway. Hello, Henry.
Hello, Anna-Marie. I'm delighted to be your guest.
You call yourself a broadcaster, musicologist, author, and lecturer, and you've had an incredibly illustrious career. So could you give us a short intro to summarize your life up to now?
Well, it's been a long life, Anna-Marie. I won't tell the listeners how old I am, but I've been on this planet Earth for a long, long time. So I've had a long career, a wonderful opportunity. Not that I've been so marvelous or so clever, but maybe I've practiced for 40 years, I always like to say, because I've been a light music broadcaster for 40 years. That is virtually a lifetime. I've broadcast literally thousands of programs and series in South Africa and overseas. I hold two world records, broadcasting records. In 2001, I did a series on Les Brown, which ran for 60 hours. That's not 1-6, that's 6-0.
Goodness.
60 hours. Then in 2004/5/6, I broke that record by doing a series on Glenn Miller called Miller Magic, which ran for 115 half hours. 115 half hour programs. Now, that leads us very quickly to probably the highlight of my life. On the 2nd of March 2003, in Los Angeles, I received America's prestigious Golden Bandstand Award. That award has been given to only two non-Americans in history, one in London and me. To really put some perspective on it, of the American legends, about just over 50 of them, you can include Frank Sinatra, Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington. That gives you an idea that old Henry is in pretty good company. I also, in June 2009, I became the first ever non-American to be the Grand Marshal on the Glenn Miller Birthplace Society's parade through Clarinda, Iowa, where Glenn Miller was born. And also, during that week, in fact, the day just before that, I also became the first non-American on their prestigious discussion panel, Glenn Miller Birthplace Society's discussion panel on Glenn Miller. Full house in the hall. And then a charming little first as well. On the 6th of June 2009, I was the special guest of Ginny Mancini, the widow of the legendary Henry Mancini, at her marvelous penthouse on Wilshire Boulevard. There were 20 guests for dinner, cocktails first and dinner, and some legends among the people who accepted to come to that dinner, people like Julie Andrews and Tony Martin, just to mention two of them. I think that being honored as the special guest for that evening really gave me quite a kick. Not quite as big as the Golden Bandstand Award and the others that I mentioned, but it was something really special. Something else that I'd like to mention, that American Ambassador William Lacey Swing officially opened my music studio in Cape Town in 1992. Now, my music studio is called Swingdom, and the ambassador's surname is Swing. So that tells you something, doesn't it?
Yes.
Then, on the 28th of September 1999, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences invited me to Los Angeles to the celebration of Les Brown's 60 years of leading his famed band of renown. That is now in the Guinness Book of World Records, and they had a special dinner and function on the evening of the 28th of September 1999 in the Beverly Wilshire Hotel's ballroom. I was invited by Steve Allen, who was the master of ceremonies, to sit at his table. There were two VIP tables, the Les Brown family table and the master of ceremonies table. Steve Allen being the master of ceremonies. Now, Steve Allen, the name might not mean anything to you, but Steve Allen is probably the most talented all-round television and musical man ever. He also played Benny Goodman in the movie The Benny Goodman Story, for those of you who saw Benny Goodman's story. Mm. And Les Brown invited me to sit at his table. And when he went to the microphone, got up from the table at 8 o'clock, went up to the microphone and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the very first thing that I want to say is I want to invite someone who's come 10,000 miles from South Africa mm-hmm. to be here with us. Mm-hmm. He has broadcast the music of Les Brown and Les Brown's peers for 25 years, at that time, of course it was, for 25 years internationally. Mr. Henry Holloway." Well, the place, there were 1,000 American music VIPs in the ballroom, and the place went mad. The television camera swung over to me, the flash floodlights swung over to me. Wonderful. And they applauded and applauded, and I bowed and I smiled and I waved, and it went on and on and on. It was just too marvelous for words. You know, these are maybe little things, but big things. I've been very fortunate to be the guest at home, at their homes, of people like Artie Shaw, the legendary Artie Shaw, Les Brown just mentioned, Ray Evans, the lyricist, Milt Bernhardt, the trombone player, Bob Crosby, not Bing, but Bob, his brother. Okay. So it goes on and on. And of course, I can also mention that when I won the Golden Bandstand Award in 2003, I got special letters culminating in photographs with, among others, F.W. de Klerk, Cyril Ramaphosa, Desmond Tutu, Gary Player, Ernie Els. I can go on and on and on, and so forth and so forth and so forth. And then I can just mention that in South Africa, 6 or 7 television programs have been broadcast about me, 2 in the USA. There have been dozens of articles about me in South Africa, 10 or more in the USA, in the United Kingdom. And so it goes on and on and on. Now, it sounds like bragging. I'm not a bragger. I'm just a humble man. And I'm just grateful that the good Lord has spared me and has blessed me in so many ways. And I can be forever, forever grateful. Now, really, this is just a summary of some of the things that happened to me. But I want to go back to the beginning. How did all this happen? Where did it start?
Yes, exactly.
There must have been a start. When I grew up in a very poor circumstances, but we were always happy. We were always clean. My father died when I was 8, but my mother used to take in menial work. She did things for people so that we can just put life and limb together for my brother, my elder brother, and myself. Mm. But we were very happy boys. We went to school. We did well at school. And then when I was in high school, I used to go in some afternoons to the Phillips Cafe in the town of Vereeniging, which is south of Johannesburg. Okay. And I used to listen to those little jukeboxes. They had these places where you sat, and there were little jukeboxes in each little booth. Yes. And you could play these different types of music. And in those days, I'm now talking about, it must have been about 1950 roughly, I used to play Glenn Miller records. And Glenn Miller records really touched me, and that was the beginning of me falling in love with the music and developing a passion for the Glenn Miller music. Yes. And subsequently the other similar big bands, many of them, too many to mention now, but Glenn Miller was my first idol. And I remember Sweet Eloise and Sleep Song. It was a 78. You know, in those old days, they had these 78 RPM records, these old shellac records, two sides, Sleep Song on the one side and Sweet Eloise on the other side. And maybe this would be a good opportunity, after all that gabble and gabble by Henry, to play Sleep Song or Sweet Eloise.
Eloise, sing the birds in the trees. When she is near, you can hear them singing sweet melodies. They're just for my Eloise. My Eloise. Sweet Eloise is a beautiful sight. Old Mr. Moon comes around to look at her every night. Her smile's a warm summer breeze, the smile of Eloise. And though there may be clouds in the skies, there's always sunshine deep in her eyes. In case you didn't know, roses grow hoping someday they'll be pressed and caressed in her bouquet. Sweet Eloise is so lovely to love, you will agree she's the only girl that you're dreaming of. But you'll be wasting your time, 'cause Eloise is all mine. She's all mine. Sweet Eloise is so lovely to love, and you will agree she's the only girl that you're dreaming of. But you'll be wasting your time, 'cause Eloise is all mine. So don't you give her a line, 'cause Eloise is all mine.
Sweet Eloise, Glenn Miller and his orchestra, from an old 78 RPM shellac record. Oh, I think it was around about 1941 or 42. I mean, recorded then, but a long, long time ago. And that is where it all started for me.
That's wonderful. It's incredible music. I've always loved big band music too. Listeners, yes, you were with Radio Overberg, 98.4. I'm Anna-Marie, and I'm interviewing Henry Holloway, the incredible man who's had such an illustrious career in music with big bandstand music. He even received an award, a Golden Bandstand Award, for just playing the music and promoting music. Am I right? You don't even play an instrument.
Well, good question, Anna-Marie. I was, funnily enough, a young, quite good singer.
All right.
In those long away Vereniging days.
Okay.
When I started listening to Glenn Miller and the other big bands, and the singers, of course, Bing Crosby, first of all, was my first hero, and then Frank Sinatra came, you know.
Yes.
Bing Crosby had a wonderful saying. He was quoted one day as saying, Frank Sinatra comes along once in a lifetime, but why should it be my lifetime?
Yes.
So Bing was before Frank, but Bing was my first vocal hero. Glenn Miller was my first orchestral hero. And then, of course, Frank Sinatra overtook them all. And as we speak today, if I have to name, I'd like to name two singers, my two most favorite singers.
Please.
Frank Sinatra, number one.
All right.
And Ella Fitzgerald, number two.
Oh, yes, wonderful. Singer.
And I'd like to quote Bing Crosby again. He said on another occasion, man, woman, or child, Ella's the greatest. So there you
wonderful,
are, quoting
nice.
Bing, whom I never knew personally, but I knew his brother Bob personally very well, and I'll get to Bob in a few moments, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I would like to do is to, well, I guess you were going to ask me about this rather massive book lying in front of you, Anna-Marie.
I was going to ask you because it's really an impressive book. It's not just a little book. It's a huge book. I haven't looked, but I think there are
716 pages altogether.
And lots and lots of photographs.
500 images in it, including photographs, articles, letters from the legends to me and from me to them, etc., etc. It weighs 2 kilograms. It's been published in America, which I think is another rather unique thing for a South African. I don't know how many autobiographies of South Africans are published in America, but this one was published in Bloomington, Indiana, USA, by Trafford Publishing, and I'm rather proud of it. It's a lifetime of work and passion for the American music. Incidentally, this book is now available on Amazon.com, Trafford.com, BarnesandNoble.com. It's available in paper form, the one you see right in front of you. And it's also available in Kindle or e-book form. And in South Africa, recently, it's become available on Takealot.com.
No, I just wanted to ask you, when was it actually published?
It was published roughly 2 months ago.
All right, so it's pretty recent.
Yes.
And I think every household in South Africa at least should have one because it looks absolutely incredibly interesting.
Well, I think you should be my marketing agent. You see this seal next to my right ear on the cover. That says the gold seal of literary excellence.
I saw that and what is that?
Now, Anna-Marie, I've asked my contact at Trafford, and he said to me, Henry, not many books get that gold seal of literary excellence. It's not given by Trafford. It's given by the U.S. Review of Books, a separate organization, who they review all books. And it was given by them. And to have this seal on the front cover of my book next to my right ear, I believe is pretty awesome.
That is absolutely an incredible achievement. Now tell us, what I'd like to know is, how did the idea of a book start?
Yes, good question. In 2009, when I was on one of my many, many trips to the USA, I think I did about a dozen altogether, I think I mentioned a couple of things that happened, the Grand Marshal through the Clarinda, Iowa, and also on the discussion panel, and also Jenny Mancini's dinner.
Yes.
And I was staying with Betty Rose, the widow of David Rose, in Los Angeles. And a lot of visitors came to visit me there, and a lady came up from very far south of Southern California, and she said her name was Joanne McGinnis. She was a teacher. She spoke 6 languages. She was an author, an editor. She's a writer, and she would be happy. This was over lunch that we were having, Betty Rose and grandson Adam and Joanne and myself. And Joanne said she would be happy to type my book. She would be happy to... She asked me if I'd written a book, and I said no. She said, well, you should write a book. And she said, what's more, I will type it for you, I will edit it for you, I will oversee the whole book for you, and it won't cost you a penny.
Oh, that's amazing.
Well, now, to get an offer like that...
Oh, no, you have to take it.
You have to take it. So that's where it started, in 2009. In fact, in September 2009, I started writing. It took me 5.5 years... to complete it.
And that was my next question. Actually, did you write it all yourself?
I wrote it, typed it on emails, sent it to Joanne, and sent photographs, and I got another lady from California. When Joanne got sick and tired of me after about 3 or 4 years, especially the photographs, a young lady called Diane Whitman, she said she would happily do. She was introduced to me. She would happily do the photographs. She was a photo editor, and so she did the photographs for me.
Yes.
But altogether, it took 5.5 years to complete.
That's a mammoth task.
Mammoth. I was sitting at that computer, computer day in, day out. Boy, oh boy, oh boy.
But did it give you a lot of satisfaction?
It gave me a lot of satisfaction. It took so much time, if you can imagine, doing the thing chronologically.
Yes.
And finding the photographs from my massive, massive collection all over our property.
Good
to get them in chronological order.
Yes,
that's
of
why
course.
It took so long. And yes, I'm just delighted that it's finally
yes,
come to.
Yes, of course.
And by the way, talking about Jenny Mancini, she wrote a review, which is in the book near the front. But that review of hers was used in the official Trafford publicity page, which they send all over. And I'm very proud about that. And talking about reviews, once the book has started selling, a lady, a famous pianist, New York lady, called Nora Raphael, she bought a book, and she wrote a wonderful review in the official Amazon.com page.
All right.
She's a world-class jazz/swing pianist, and I play her CDs on my radio programs regularly, and she wrote this awesome review on Amazon.com.
That's
and so it'll take quite a while to go through this book, to read through it. A fellow from Scotland who bought this book said to me he stopped going to the gym now. He uses this book to build up his muscles, to pick it up and do his curls and push-ups and things with it.
Dumbbells.
Which is rather dumbbells, like dumbbells, rather interesting.
But you also had glowing reviews from many, many people, and one of them is Diane Elliott. Is she anybody in particular?
Well, now, Diane Elliott was the lady who wrote the official U.S. review of books, review.
Oh,
she was
right.
The one... She has nothing to do with Trafford Publishing. She's with the U.S. Review of Books, and she wrote a wonderful review of the book and put recommended at the bottom, which I believe they don't do all the time anyway. She might well be the one who suggested the Gold Seal of Literary Excellence. They weren't prepared to tell me exactly who. You know, they sort of hide these things away from authors all over the world.
All right.
She certainly did that. I think while we are gabbling, at least I'm gabbling, maybe we should just stop here and play something else.
Please, you must have such an incredibly vast library of music. I would love to see it. I just can't even imagine.
You're on the ball, Anna-Marie Connolly. I have one of the largest private collections in the world, and this is where all my pennies went into, right?
Awesome.
from those high school
yes.
days of Glenn Miller. When I first, I didn't tell you the story. I said to the Greek cafe
yes.
owner, I said to the Greek cafe owner one day, I said, "Please, sir, can I buy that record, Sweet
yes.
Eloise and Sleep Song?" He said to me, "Listen, young man, I don't own these records. They come from Johannesburg. Every few months they bring new stock. But when the guy comes from Johannesburg, I will talk to him." And a few weeks later, when I walked into the Phillips Cafe, there he was standing with a record in his
lovely.
Hand.
Was and it the 78?
78. Mm. And he said, "Here's the record." And I said, "Good heavens, sir, thank you. What do I owe you?" He said, "No, it's yours for free."
Why?
That was my first ever record. That was Glenn Miller's Sleep Song and Sweet Eloise, 78 RPM. That was given to me by the Greek cafe owner, of course, the record company via
wonderful?
The Greek cafe
oh,
owner.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But that's how I got that record.
And that's wonderful. And you must have played it so that the grooves were obviously like very deep in the end, but you still have it.
I still have it, and it'll be on this program. But I think we should choose something else now.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
That was Benny Goodman's Let's Dance. This is Radio Overberg 98.4. I'm Anna Marie, and I'm got in the studio with me Mr. Henry Holloway, and we are discussing his book, amongst other things. Another thing I wanted to say, you said you were a singer, but did you play any musical instruments? Because what is a musicologist exactly?
I'm glad you asked that question, Anna Marie. I didn't complete that story. The brain jumps in too many directions when you get to my age.
All right, I'm gonna keep
I was very keen to start playing an instrument, but because my dear old mother couldn't afford the singing, the piano lessons, I started piano lessons, she couldn't afford it. I just naturally followed Bing and Frank and Perry Como and Dick Hames and all those great singers of the 30s and 40s. I started singing, and in Vereeniging I sang with local bands. I developed that skill, and in fact I was a pretty good singer. And nowadays when I look back, I say to myself, Holloway, you idiot, you should have kept on singing professionally. You might have got somewhere, because these guys make so much money nowadays. But that was another world. And no, I did not master an instrument, but I was musically inclined. Now, to say that I am a musicologist, I know I've been a light music broadcaster for 40 years, but as the years went by, I became so knowledgeable in all aspects of light music that the Americans started, because they got to know me better and better. You see, when I founded the Glenn Miller Appreciation Society of South Africa in 1974, when I did my first series, that was my first series. I did a series on Glenn Miller called Miller Magic.
But you did it in South Africa with the SABC.
I did it all in South Africa, all my radio series in South Africa.
And how did the Americans come to know about it?
Because in those days they had, at the SABC, they had Radio RSA, which was the external service of Radio South Africa. They had two series there. One was called The Big Bands, and one was called Music in the Sun.
Okay.
And they asked me to broadcast on both those programs.
All right.
And those programs went to Africa, to Europe, and to America. And that's where
that's
the Americans
incredible.
Started hearing me firstly.
Okay.
And, of course, my Back to the Big Bands in the 80s ran for 6 years. And then some idiot came in as head of service, and he chopped me. But fortunately, the boss of light music in the music department said to me, Henry, come and talk to me about this. And I told him the story, and he said, look, you think of something else. I will take care of this man. No names mentioned, no pack drill. And I walked past Lance James' office. His office was next to mine. And I heard some beautiful big band medium tempo music coming from his office. And I walked in there and I said, Lance, what is that? Who is that?
Yeah.
And he showed me a record cover, Oscar Brandenburg and his big band. Mm. And I said, what is that thing playing there? He said, it's called Life is Nothing Without Music. I said, wow.
Is your motto.
And that is my, from that day onward, I took that record to this fellow from the music department and I played it to him. And I said to him, from now on, I'm going to start a new program called Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz. And I'm going to use this tune, Life is Nothing Without Music, as my theme. And there you can see it on the cover of my book.
Yes, it's everywhere.
From 1985. Now, how long is that?
30 years.
30 years that Life is Nothing Without Music has been my theme. And Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz has existed. That's why my book is also called Swing, Sing, and All That
Jazz. Yes, no, that's what we all know you for.
Yeah.
But the fact that the Americans have actually given you all these accolades, is that just from hearing your music being broadcast from South Africa?
All right, no, it's not. Let me tell you what happened. The 1970s, after I founded the Glenn Miller Appreciation Society of South Africa in 1974, and I also founded the Big Band Society of South Africa in 1977, I started writing to these American legends. Firstly, the Miller ones, the ones who still lived. This is the 1970s and the early 80s I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And they started writing back to me.
Okay.
And I brought out a newsletter every month for my Glenn Miller Society and for my Big Band Society called In the Mood. Which was one of Glenn's biggest hits.
My favorite.
And I sent them to these people whom I was corresponding with. And Professor Dr. Paul Tanner, who was at UCLA, was the first one. Tex Beneke was the second one. Billy May was the third one. And so it went on and on and on. And I started corresponding with these people, and I put on the back of my In the Mood they were my honorary members, honorary life members. And I started befriending them. When I went over to America for the first time in 1981, I visited Paul Tanner. He took me to Tex Beneke. Billy May came over to Texas House. And this is where it started. It's all a snowball effect. Paula Kelly, Paul Tanner took me down to Paula Kelly's house and took me down to Bob Crosby's house. And so it went on and on and on. And the one thing led to the other.
Mm.
And these, I can virtually say dozens of these famous people all became my friends. And they all gave me CDs of themselves to play on my radio program.
Okay.
So there was a quid pro quo.
That's fantastic.
I stayed with him. I only once stayed in a hotel. On all my visits, only once for a few days. I never stayed in hotels. I always stayed with these famous people.
Yes.
They became my friends. And that's how it all snowballed. It was a snowball effect.
So you went over to America quite often?
I went to America, I've stopped counting. 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, I can't remember, but many times.
But was it all in aid of your program that you come back?
It was all in aid of getting to know these people.
Right.
Because we became corresponding friends,
yeah.
I wanted to become personal friends of theirs. And, of course, I promoted their music on my programs. I mean, here I've got a CD of Bob Crosby, for instance.
Is that now the one you said it was? Was it Bing's brother?
Bob Crosby was Bing's brother. And he's, I've got here on the CD.
And he's a musician too.
Two beautiful ones. I think we must play something.
Yes, definitely.
Let me see, what have we got here? I've got a nice one here by Bob Crosby that we will play. Lazy. Oh yes, that's a beautiful one. Bing sings it, and Bob Crosby's band plays it. Bob and Bing did about a dozen or so numbers together. Lazy is one of my favorites. So, Lazy is our next number.
Lazy, I just want to be lazy. I long to be out in the sun with no work to be done. Under that awning they call the sky, stretching and yawning, and let the world go drifting by. I want to peep through the deep tangled wildwood, counting sheep till I sleep just like a child would, with a great big valise full of books to read where it's peaceful, while I'm killing time being lazy. That deep tangled wildwood, counting sheep till I sleep just like a child would, with a great big bulging valise full of books to read where it's peaceful, while I'm killing time just being lazy.
Lazy, Bing Crosby singing, and being accompanied by his younger brother Bob Crosby and his orchestra. Bing and Bob, I think, did about a dozen or more recordings together, and I got to know Bob Crosby very well. Bing, I never knew. He died in 77. I never got to know Bing, but I got to know Bob very well.
Well, that's so interesting, because I think most people, well, like me, I didn't even know Bing had a brother called Bob who was a musician. I mean, that's quite some news to me.
He was a singer too. He was Fantastic. A singer too. And I can tell some very interesting stories which Bob told me about Bing, but I'd rather keep it to myself.
for another book.
For another book.
We're on Radio Overbook talking to Mr. Henry Holloway. What was the story about Glenn Miller's probable fate or his disappearance?
Right. Where shall I start, Anna-Marie? Mm-hmm. I think I'll start as follows.
All right.
In 1984, I did a 51-part series on Glenn Miller, again titled Miller Magic.
Yes.
And the series had hardly started when I also persuaded the television department to screen the Glenn Miller story near to his birthday, which is the 1st of March. I think it was screened on the 2nd or 3rd of March, 1984. And shortly after that day, when Stuart Doyle, a senior technical man from the SABC, came out of his office and virtually bumped into me, and he said, "Henry, I'm so glad I see you now, because we had a meeting of moths." That's not a little insect. It's the memorable order of Tenats, these ex-war guys. He said the other night, and one of our Moths members, a fellow called Fred Shaw, who was a navigator in the RAF during the Second World War, said to me after the meeting, "You know, I was watching the Glenn Miller story the other night, and I swear that I saw Glenn Miller's little plane go down in the English Channel on the 15th of December, 1944.
Goodness.
And Stuart Doyle said to him, "Then I must introduce you to Henry Holloway." And I said, "Stewie, that's wonderful. Now give me Fred Shaw's telephone number," which he turned around and gave me. I don't know where I was heading, but I turned right around, went back to my office and phoned this man. And I said to him, "Mr. Shaw," and he answered the phone. He said, "Yes." I said, "My name is Henry Holloway." He said, "I know you. I listen to your programs." I said, "Oh, thank you very much. Now, Mr. Shaw, Glenn Miller's disappearance." He said, "Yes." I said, "Would you do me a big favor and come to my Glenn Miller Appreciation Society meeting, the next one, 29th of April, 1984, and come and tell the story to my members?" He said, "Yes, I'll do it with pleasure. Only one problem." I said, "What's that?" "No car." I said, "That's not a problem. I'll pick you up. Give me your address." He gave me his address. I picked him up. He went to the meeting. He told the story. Slim, neat, well-dressed, 60-odd years old, in his 60s, soft-spoken, but quite affirmative. And he told the story of how 138 Lancaster bombers were ordered to go and bomb a little railway yard called Siegen near Cologne in Germany on the 15th of December 1944, and the weather was very bad. They were supposed to take off at 6 o'clock and they could not take off. They waited and waited and waited until about noon, somewhere in that region, and then they eventually took off. Now, each of these 138 Lancaster bombers had a contingent of bombs aboard, but they each had one cookie, which was a sort of a strange looking bomb with little detonators, and these cookies would not actually explode when they hit the surface. They would actually explode, and I put that in inverted commas, about 6 feet above any surface that they would hit, and the blast waves would cause the problems from these bombs. And they went towards Siegen, And before they got into German airspace, they were recalled because the weather was getting worse and worse and worse. And they came back and they could not land with these cookies because they were so dangerous.
Oh,
so they had to jettison them. And they jettisoned them in the English Channel south of Beachy Head. And as these bombs were being dropped into the English Channel, Fred Shaw got up from his navigator's seat and he looked through the Perspex blister at the bottom of the plane, watching these blasts go off, these bombs explode 6 feet above the water surface, and the blasts. And all of a sudden, he saw a little single-engine high-wing monoplane called a Norseman, and he knew it was a Norseman because he trained on Norsemen early in his career in Canada, and he recognized it as a Norseman. And Glenn Miller took off in a Norseman on that same day from an airfield near Bedford. And Fred Shaw saw this little Norseman, and he saw the bombs go off around him and the blast waves, and all of a sudden he saw this little plane tilt on its left side and go into the English Channel. And he said, "It's gone in." And the tail end Charlie, the tail gunner, said, "Yes, I could see it." And they just went off, and they got back, and they weren't debriefed because they didn't complete their mission. So they just carried on with their lives. And that evening, not that evening, sorry, on the evening of 24 December, Christmas Eve, they heard over the radio that Major Glenn Miller had disappeared on the 15th of December, 9 days ago, 9 days previous to that, and he was, all three occupants of the plane and the plane were missing. They haven't found it yet. There was a Major Glenn Miller, of course, on the plane. There was a Colonel Norman Basel on the plane, and there was the pilot flight officer, Johnny Morgan. And those three bodies were never found. The plane was never found. But that is how Fred Shaw swore. Look, he didn't say that was Glenn Miller's plane.
No,
he just said it was a Norseman. But putting two and two together, you can come up with what you want.
And they never investigated that?
Of course they did.
And?
Many people investigated it. Now, there's a fellow called Dennis Sprague in Colorado, who's a friend of mine, a friend of Alan Cass as well, whom I mentioned earlier, couldn't remember Alan's title. And Dennis Sprague has done tremendous research. He's even spoken to the Queen. He's done tremendous research over some years now. And we correspond regularly, and he's written a book called Resolved.
Yeah.
And he reckons that tells what happened to Glenn Miller. But nobody knows exactly what's in that book because it hasn't been published. He's trying to get a publisher. So, in fact, we were having a little competition as to whose book would be published first, and I beat him.
That's
Resolved to this very day is not yet published because he can't find a publisher.
Of course.
But he reckons that, yes, Glenn Miller did take place, and I spoke to two people in England, one lady who was on duty in this little airfield just outside Bedford in England, who saw Major Miller and two other officers arrive in a car. He saw the three of them walking to the little plane which landed. He saw Major Miller and the other officer get into the plane and the third one go back to the Jeep. And she, Ann Carroll, the lady's name was, she was on duty in the little watchtower there on that day. She saw it, and I phoned her up. She's dead now, but I phoned her up then, and she confirmed it, what she saw, to me. And a man wrote a book, Missing, Believed, Killed, I think the book is called. And he mentioned my story, my part in the book as well, and Ann Carroll's part as well. And he researched it. He was a researcher. And I have a copy of the book at home with a nice inscription from the author. And so we'll see what Dennis Sprague comes up with in his book, Resolved.
Gosh, I hope it comes out soon.
We'll hear what Dennis Sprague thinks really happened to Glenn. They still haven't found the body.
That's an incredible story.
They still haven't found the body.
My goodness.
No.
And they were on a military mission. It wasn't like he was on his way to have a concert or anything.
No, he was. Glenn Miller was on his way to Paris to go and set up facilities for a Christmas broadcast.
Oh.
He was going to set up all the facilities, where to stay and everything else for them. And when the rest of the band flew over on the 18th of December, they went to Orly Airfield, and Glenn Miller said they must ask for him before he left. They must ask when they get to Orly. And when Don Haynes, his second in charge, went to the desk clerk at Orly Airport and said, Major Miller. And this guy said, Major Miller never arrived.
Oh, how sad.
So they searched everywhere through Paris.
Oh, my goodness.
Everywhere. They couldn't find anybody who knew anything about Major Miller.
How incredibly sad. I mean, what brilliant musician. I mean, after that, we still simply have to play more of his music, don't you think?
Well, that's a brilliant idea. I think we should play one more track by Glenn Miller. Let me just scratch around in my bag here and see what I can find.
Get up, it's morning. Go back to sleep, to dream again.
And as I take you in my arms, that's when
I gotta get up again. For the bugler man is a silly man, got all day to practice his horn.
But he waits instead till we're all in bed, then he starts to make with his corn.
Why go to sleep? For if I sleep,
I'll only start to dream of you, and then
I gotta get up again.
The Sleep Song by Glenn Miller. This is 98.4 Radio Overberg. I'm Anna Maria, and in the studio I have Mr. Henry Holloway. Henry, you were married to quite a famous singer, South African singer, Eve Boswell.
I was indeed for 9 years, Anna Marie. Believe it or not, she asked me to marry her on the very first day of 1976, which was leap year.
Leap year, oh fantastic.
And after 9 years, I divorced her because she drove me crazy. She was impossible to live with. Nothing is all bad or all good. She opened many doors for me.
Okay.
But she was impossible to live with. So I divorced her. But before I tell you the charming end to the story, maybe we should just play something by Eve Boswell. And I would like to play something from a CD which I produced. Well, it was still an LP, It was called It's a Breeze, the title of the LP. So let us play the title track, It's a Breeze, which was Eve Boswell, backed by the South African Broadcasting Corporation Dance Band, musical director Rollo Scott.
When you hear a band that's swinging, or you dig Sinatra singing, when the Duke is highland flinging, it's a breeze. If you're in the upper set, go to first nights at the Met. Hey man, it's a gas, it's a ring-a-ding-ding, it's a breeze. When you're in a jet high-flying, or you back a horse that's trying, if the fish you caught is frying, it's a breeze. When you slam the hole in one, or you're tanning in the sun, hey man, it's a gas, it's a ring-a-ding-ding, it's a breeze. A trip to Europe on the QE2, a holiday, search for something new. But if it's love you're really craving, with a home, a heart, a haven, then it's time you started saving. It's a breeze when the jackpot you have hit, and you tell your boss, I quit. Hey man, it's a gas, it's a ring-a-ding-ding, it's a breeze. When you're sailing on the Med in your new yacht, you couldn't give a damn, no matter what. But when you find the ball is over, and you're tired of being a rover, and you still can live in clover, it's a breeze. When you dig a guy that's got it, and the marriage ties be knotted, hey man, it's a guess, it's a ring-a-ding-ding, it's a breeze. Hey man, it's a guess, it's a ring-a-ding-ding, it's a breeze.
Now, you know, Anna-Marie, I was very fortunate in 1985 to meet Marilyn Foster.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you next.
You were going to ask me about Marilyn. Well, Marilyn Foster was editor of Women's World
a
record number of years, more than any other editor in the 40 years of the history of Women's World. And we have now been married for almost 30 years, and Marilyn has looked after me very well. That's why I'm looking pretty good for my age.
That's fantastic.
And I want to just tell you quickly that before we have to close this program, we've chatted so much, that Marilyn did her master's on the music of Cole Porter.
Oh.
Some musicologist was behind her there.
Oh, goodness.
And now she's doing a doctorate on the lyrics of Sammy Kahn.
That's incredible. So you have that in common, this love
of
good music.
Well, Marilyn now knows more about Cole Porter than I know, and she knows more about Sammy Kahn than I know. And people say, Sammy who? Well, Sammy Kahn holds the world record as a lyricist. That's the guy who writes the words.
Yes.
He holds the world record, 26 Oscar nominations. Runner-up Johnny Mercer with 18 Oscar nominations, and also they both won 4 Oscars. Sammy Kahn won his Oscars, let's see, All the Way, High Hopes, Call Me Irresponsible, and 3 Coins in the Fountain.
Okay.
I don't have any of those
with me,
but let us play one of his great songs that he wrote with Julie Stein, middle 40s, early 40s. This one is called It's Been a Long, Long Time, and it's sung by Helen Forrest.
I me once, then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear, since can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You'll never know how many dreams I dreamed about you, or just how empty they all seemed without you. So kiss me once, then kiss me twice, kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time.
Henry, I'm afraid we've come to the end of the time. It's just been incredible. Time flies when you're having fun.
Indeed.
And it sounds like it's been one hell of a ride for you.
Indeed.
And so thank you so much for your time. It's been a privilege and an honor talking with you.
Anna Marie Connolly, you're a sweetie pie, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.